Thank you for tuning in to Gila Memories Community Radio, KURU, Silver City, New Mexico, 89.1 FM, and everywhere online at gmcr.org. Welcome to Tuesday Morning Beat. My name's Mary McHugh, and I'll be with you for another hour along with my co-host, Scott Plate. This is the fourth Tuesday of the month, so we have our special episode of Beyond the Border. We talk about death and dying, how to live well and die well, and what that means, really, on an individual, collective, and social justice framework. And I have to always say a disclaimer. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed are the speaker's own and do not represent the views, thoughts, and opinions of GMCR KURU. Good morning, Scott Plate.
Good morning. It's so nice to be back.
Okay, is this like our 12th session?
This is our 12th. Next in July was our July 23rd of 2024 was our very first one. So this is technically our 12th episode. We're coming up on a one-year anniversary.
Kind of like a punch card. Now, what do we get? What do we get for free?
I don't know. A future? Maybe.
A good death.
A good death.
Yeah.
A path forward. I just want to start by saying thank you again to you for having the vision to include this as part of a program that had already had several trips around the sun and a clear direction and a clear mission, and for you to be able to see that there was a way of reframing the idea of what a border was, mm-hmm. you know, and with the work that we also share as end-of-life advocates. I think what happened is we sat around a table with our end-of-life Options New Mexico colleagues and recognized the collective wisdom that was gathered there in so many different ways and decided to begin a conversation about death as a social justice issue. And the ground that we've covered in a year gave me pause for reflection. I thought this might be a nice time to just kind of figure out what's emerged for us, you know, over a year. And you've had the benefit that I have not have of going back and editing these episodes and really going through them with a fine-tooth comb so we can get, really extract what's essential from what people's wisdom is. So I'm grateful for that perspective as well. I went through it from a more of a, you know, macro perspective, but you've had the benefit of really hearing it over and over again. But I think what I've discovered over the year is what we set out to do was expand the idea of death beyond a personal experience and put it onto a landscape of culture. You know, cultural frontier, as it were, and who has access to agency at the end of life? Who among us in our society can actually hold on to a measure of autonomy and power? And how can the agency that we give to a dying person be seen as an act of love? So the voices that have gathered over the course of a year have woven this amazing collective of, I would just say, wisdom and understanding, and we've been guided through a really interesting, intricate understanding of what death is and how it can become a teacher for us. So, you know, I'm grateful, and, you know, there are possibilities, you know, we've discussed for a path forward for the program, which include having people phone in, you know, once we get some training, and, you know, that's a piece that we have to address ourselves to in good time. But I'm really grateful for the commitment that this community makes to exploring death. And you and I were just talking before we began the program about a program you'll be leading at the Lotus Center in a month, you know, talking about end-of-life work. Mm-hmm. So with a support group, a grief support group, and the more people we have having these conversations, the better. I was sharing with you, I'm in on co-facilitating an end-of-life class at the UU Fellowship. And yesterday, the subject matter was writing your own obituary. And this gave pause to a lot of people because they've been studying the practical aspects of their own death, advanced directive paperwork, you know, all of the above. And the unspoken elephant or the invisible elephant in the room was spending this time talking about my own demise, especially if I'm aging in place alone, can trigger some really intense feelings. And what emerged from this discussion was there's a space in this community for having conversations about what we're afraid of, what we don't understand, what we're uncertain about in a non-judgmental, inclusive, ecumenical, you know, container. So I think in a way that's what this program has become. And I'm hoping that more and more people can add to our wisdom as we go. So thank you for that. That's my opening spiel.
And that's your opening spiel.
Yeah.
So that summarizes a lot of things,
mm-hmm.
and also reflects the multi dimensions of what we're talking about, how we're living, how we're aging in place, how we're preparing for our death, how we even talk about it, et cetera, et cetera. There's so many dimensions to this conversation. And over the last 12 months, we hosted a person who was a volunteer with End of Life Options New Mexico, their perspective of it, what's their experience, what's their wisdom around it. You have extrapolated several themes.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about those themes.
So I think framing the issue of death as a social justice issue to kind of come in line with what this program is who has access to agency at the end of their life. And right now there are, I think, 12 states plus the District of Columbia. New York just recently signed on, as did Delaware, having a law which provides medical assistance in dying should a patient meet certain criteria. So the interesting paradox that the show really began with was, even though death is the one thing that is promised to all of us, not all of us have equal access to it when we choose to. Karen DeGeneveve in here and Tawana, both of whom are fierce advocates for autonomy through life and through the end of life, and how can we, through this conversation, foster that ongoing sense of making the access point accessible to everyone. It's a profoundly personal experience, our own death. We don't have a lot of collective wisdom about what happens when we die, because very few have gone over and come back with any sense of what actually happened. Some have a very clear sense. But the question really was, how can we enter into a relationship with it that is as universal as death itself is? Because like we said, it's the one thing that happens to all of us. It's the one thing that's promised to us. However, very few of us have a choice about when that will happen. The second piece that came through is, really, we had a great amount of time spent, and fortunately we have, you know, people who are well positioned to speak about this, is about the New Mexico's Medical Aid in Dying Law. It came in, you know, in 2021, the Elizabeth Whitfield Law, that came in line with a national movement toward death with dignity. You know, we had Adrienne Dare on, you know, who is really instrumental in shepherding this law through several unsuccessful legislative session attempts till finally it passed. We had Tawana and Karen, Dr. Tawana Sparks and Karen DeGeneveve, another nurse practitioner colleague of ours, who are, along with you, really bedside with people who've chosen this issue and their experience. And how the medical healthcare providers made a transition in their own hearts and minds from first do no harm and trying to save lives into, how can I extend the definition of what I would call care to include compassionate endings
and alleviation of
suffering. Absolutely.
There's a lot of suffering around death.
There sure is.
Yeah.
And I think the law ultimately had compassion at its core. Because if you are diagnosed with a terminal illness, which means in this case less than 6 months of a prognosis, and you are decisionally capable, you are at least 18 years of age, you can ingest the medicine yourself, and you are a resident of New Mexico, which is fairly liberally defined, you have access to end, you have the ability to act to end your own suffering with the aid of a physician, not actually pouring the medicine down your throat, but assisting you and making sure that you're prepared and that you have agency right up until the final moment of your life and you drink that medicine. There are a number of other states that have these kinds of laws on the books, but fortunately in the past couple of months, we've had two get passed, mm-hmm. New York and Delaware. So joining, although New Mexico's, I think, is widely recognized as probably one of the more, if not the most progressive of these laws. How can we use the power of our collective understanding and compassion to create laws or access to death in a way that reflects the universality of death itself? Because, you know, very often we don't have that. another theme that came through, I would say, is the wisdom of the body. You know, for me, listening and thinking back on these episodes, we had Tori Grass in here. We had Siri Khalsa in here. And Tori's unique perspective as both, she was a nurse that presided over childbirth as well as over hospice. And Siri's experience of getting lost in the Gila unexpectedly, both of their, I would say, their collective wisdom pointed to the fact, for me, that the body actually knows how to die. The body carries an embedded wisdom. It knows exactly how to go. And our medical interventions often prolong a life past its natural expiry date. And that reflects, in a sense, that's my own belief, it reflects our fear around death. You know, I have clients for whom I'm serving as medical power of attorney, and they're very, very clear about what they want, you know. And, you know, my job as their advocate is to make sure that that happens and that it's as expressed as clearly as possible, is to extend the patient's autonomy, because there is a wisdom embedded in each body. Very often the fear, what we've learned as a culture, tends to take over and supersede that wisdom, and we don't listen to it because we're so afraid of how we feel. So a good portion, I think, of our work as we continue this conversation is to encourage people, even if it's, especially if it's involved suffering, to tune into how their body is feeling and what it's telling them, especially when it comes to the end of life. There are so many things that happen so quickly. There's loss of physical capacity. And the difficult thing for many people, I think, and I saw this in my own family, is I don't like what's happening to my body, so I don't listen to it.
People can get shut down in the face of fear. And
yes,
the fear is real. And for most of us, who have witnessed death or the process of dying, we've seen suffering and incapacity, and you know, someone has to help you to the bathroom, or you can't get to the bathroom, or you can't care for yourself. Who wants to be incapacitated in that manner?
Precisely.
Yeah. So there's fear about who will take care of me? What burden will I be on those who do take care of me? So there's a lot of avoidance that we don't want to think about it. It's just too unpleasant to think about. Or conversely, you're a person who doesn't have anybody to care for you. Mm-hmm. You know, someone who is aging in place solo. And that's a big consideration for baby boomers, because there are a lot of people who maybe they never married, maybe they never had children. For many good reasons, they chose their life path. And so they don't have kids and grandkids banging on their door, making sure that they're okay. Mm-hmm. So that's where community comes in. You mentioned community, Scott. Mm-hmm. And I think that having the conversation open to the community has been extremely beneficial. You did classes through Will. That was a 3-session class. Mm-hmm. I know that Lisa Jimenez, who will be our guest in July, mm-hmm. on the fourth Tuesday of July, she's a death doula. She mm-hmm. facilitates the Death Cafe.
She does.
Yeah, so there's a lot of people doing really good work. Mm-hmm. And the Unitarians are doing a death and dying preparation, you know, financial, legal affairs in order, but spiritual and just mm-hmm. common sense affairs getting in order. So in this community, there is dialogue. If you're looking for something to plug into, you can certainly email me, Mary, M-A-R-E-E, at gmcr.org. That's my email, Mary@gmcr.org. And I can point you in the direct accessing more information.
One thing that's striking me as you're speaking is, you know, we began with the idea of social justice, which to me means equal access and autonomy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, moving the conversation from the broader kind of notion of death as a social justice issue to the law, and then bringing in Siri and Tori's kind of embodied wisdom, you know, Siri's sense of preparedness as a way of not controlling outcomes, but really listening deeply into what our nature tells us is happening. And that sense of embodied presence strikes me as a powerful form of agency, because I know what I need if I really pay attention. I will speak on my own behalf. I will advocate for myself, and I will tend to surround myself with people who are attuned to that voice if I'm in tune with it myself. So I think it was an important part of the conversation. And I think what happens for many of us who listen into the silence, we feel more alone at first in a way, because we're not hearing a voice coming back at us saying, this is what you should do, and here's the form you should sign. But the intuitive voice, in my experience, doesn't use very many words. It often comes through with something like yes or no, or this way, or this is the choice. So there's a knowing that I can begin to cultivate if I give it space. And I think giving space for this conversation has a way of promoting the kind of inner reflection that became a part of this series. And I think a very important part of this series, because there's no power quite like the power of a good idea whose time has come. And I think what is at the core of our law is autonomy is a good idea when it comes to the idea of death. Now, there may be people who disagree with this, and, you know, that provision was also written into the law, and that's okay. However, I think the wisdom embedded in each person's knowing about what's happening to them is what the law ultimately fosters. I think another core piece of this process was, you know, we had Sally Tilton on speaking about grief, because she experienced it intensely and acutely with the loss of her husband and her son, you know. And I don't have my own children, so I don't know what it's like to bring that life into the world, nor can I even imagine what it's like to lose that, you know, especially before I go. And the one thing I'll take from that, what many things I'll take from her wisdom, had to do with grief being as individual as a snowflake, being as particular and personal to each individual's story as the relationships that they're grieving are. And to create a space in our lives for grief, to cultivate an active relationship with it, if it is, for lack of a better word, extremely present on a given day and I need to be with other people, I can ask my grief, could you please just have a seat over there? And I need to do a few things. I need you, but not right now. I need my own counsel at this moment. I will be there for you. I have no doubt you will be there for me when I come back home by myself and run into my ghosts. Right now, however, I need to go and give a POE presentation on behalf of Public Outreach and Education, on behalf of End of Life Options New Mexico. I need to be present for my friends. Someone else is grieving. I need to be present for them. So the thing that what I learned from that story is that grief is an ongoing story. It continues to tell itself. And I think Mike's understanding of that is grief is love trying to continue loving. However, it's love kind of with phantom limb syndrome. The object of that desire has gone, but my love doesn't know how to stop being love. So it's like if I lose my arm, my body takes a while to catch up to the fact that arm is there. There's a muscle memory of association that continues to work as though I still have it. And, you know, in time, I come to understand that the object of my love is no longer there. So the grief does change shape. But what I got from our time with Sally is that it never really goes away, because it's rooted in love. And that's okay. It's actually proof that what I lost had real value to me. So what I got from her wisdom was how to cultivate a relationship that continues to pay dividends in my understanding. Yes, there's loss to grieve, and there's also reward for committing to it. And I think I loved those sessions, and because she brings quite a bit to the story. So rather than grief feeling like undertow that's going to drag me under, it becomes ultimately a space for reflection and reframing a narrative. Because if the person continues to live in my imagination and in my heart space, then they continue to surprise me. I find myself remembering things about my father and about my loved ones who have gone a fresh perspective on something that I thought was a finished story. And I thought, oh my goodness, that's because they're still here. And the interesting thing for me is that I recognize that these people who have now become ancestors, and they were when they were alive, but even more so since they're gone, need me to continue paying attention to this relationship. Because there are things in their story that are continuing to play out in mine. And maybe they couldn't finish the work they had begun. And they had me as a child so that I could carry them further. So grieving is a way of honoring someone's story. And we think of it as pain, as suffering, but I have come to understand that grief is continuing love. That's all it really is. And it's a word that has connotations, but I think the connotations are often, you know, sad and sorrowful, but I think what it really boils down to, it's the ongoing narrative line of love. And once we understand that, I remember a dear friend of mine who was, we call them my theater godparents in Cleveland. They were an actor and two actors who were married, had children, like Dorothy and Reuben Silver. And Reuben died, and the thought of either one of them without the other was unthinkable. And I remember seeing Dorothy at another memorial service for someone else. And Reuben had been gone a couple of years. And I said, please say hello to Reuben when you speak to him. Because I knew she did several times a day. And she looked at me with a start, like, how did you know that? And then her face softened, like, of course you would. Of course you would say that. So I wanted to acknowledge her, you know, preservation of his life through her love in saying that. So grief is a huge part of the story of death, because what we tend to focus on is the absence. But if we cultivate a kind of presence around the honor of someone's life and our willingness to honor that life, we keep someone with us. And it's not, in my view, morbid to continue to do that. It's a way I can't. At some point, the grief dissolves into the love I have for that person, and the pain diminishes. The size and shape of grief become manageable, something that I can consider without becoming capsized. And it's a beautiful evolution into the relationship that existed before the person left. The difficult part of grief is dealing with the shock of absence. Even if we know that absence is coming, there's still nothing that prepares you for the fact that I always knew this day was coming yesterday. I didn't know it was going to be today. How we carry that forward and the love that we use to tend that space, I think, helps us get through. I remember asking Tuana when she was here, you know, in her application of, you know, the medical assistance in dying law as the physician who assisted now dozens of these deaths. Mm-hmm. I can't remember exactly how many.
I want to say somewhere around 60. At this point.
Mm-hmm. I've witnessed her do this, is the tenderness that she brings to the endeavor led me to think that this is her own way of grieving. And not necessarily she carries these all, you know, as a kind of compounding grief, but that maybe the ingredient, the medicine at the end of life, yes, there's a potion that we drink, but what we try to do is attend the death with love, because without it, it doesn't feel like a death. It doesn't feel like anything is being accomplished. And I've seen it. And it's not as though the physician says to the patient, I love you, but every action in that space says those words. I think it's important for people who are curious to understand that every death is attended with love by people who assist people in this regard. Mm-hmm. And love to me is an action. It's not a feeling. I mean, I used to think it was, but it's what I do, A, when I don't feel like it, B, when it's difficult. But I understand that it's not about me, that the space itself is telling me and teaching me that this is my work. So I think it's to kind of bring the conversation about grief and death to a point. Love, which is a difficult word for many people, is the one thing I think that is powerful enough to contain them both. Because I feel in my own way, I know, and it's, I'm going to sound like a dork, but it's like, I'm kind of excited about what happens. I feel like it's a promise to me. It's almost like a betrothed. From the moment I was born, this is what I was given, you know? And here I am. I just turned 63 last week, and there's quite a bit less time in front of me than there is behind me, and it's becoming real. And I'm beginning to get really curious, and I don't know how I'll feel when I begin to feel the effects of physical deterioration and decay. But I'm interested in having those conversations as my scope begins to narrow. You talked about the fear a little earlier of people losing capacity and becoming a burden. I'm interested in what is actually expanding at that time.
Mm-hmm. Our bodies, in their own natural wisdom, are aware of breaking down, of getting older. And for some people, they're very young when their bodies start to break down. Mm-hmm. And it's that opportunity to get out of the physical dimension and expand into another dimension, which is preparation for death.
Right. The metaphysical, as you said earlier.
Yeah. It's a metaphysical situation. And I don't know how many people access that. There's so many different religious and spiritual disciplines that speak to this. And a lot of people will hang on to those beliefs and those spiritual religious disciplines to help guide them through. Let's talk about the metaphysical aspect of that.
I love that. I love that framing. And also, you know, I think what's interesting to me is if something diminishes, and what we talked about was the diminishment of physical capacity, by physics or by nature, there's space being created for something to expand. If I know what's happening to me, and if we go back to our talking, you know, about embodied presence being the ultimate form of autonomy and agency, if I can sense that my body knows what it's doing when it gradually begins to shut down, I think of it as closing a computer program and Windows did not shut down properly, we have to, you know, or whatever, or, you know, we've talked before about the image of that old TV show from the 60s, Get Smart, where all those doors close as I forget the actor's name, Don, it's gone. You know, that's part of my disintegration. I used to remember these things, but I don't. But all these doors closing little by little by little, one window or one door portal after another, in my imagination, the story I tell myself is, okay, I'm creating space for something to emerge. And when I die and when I'm gone, there's one child born in this world to carry on. So what's being born when I'm dying? If it's as literal as another life appearing on earth to replace the one that I am taking with me, or what is my death creating space for within me? And what is my awareness teaching me about what's possible? So when I work with clients as a death doula, you know, a lot of my work is rooted in who are you becoming? What are you becoming? What do you imagine is happening as you begin to let go of the corporeal? What are you creating space for? What is possible for you now? And I'm just noticing as I get older, I have a lot more thoughts running through about people who have died and who have left me a legacy. That's a kind of a heavy word for a lot of people. But what is the story they have entrusted to me that my life can continue to craft? All of a sudden, I understand a little bit more about why I was born. If I am someone that someone dreamed of being, but couldn't because of their circumstances or whatever it was that they were living at that time, what is my responsibility? I used to think I needed my ancestors, you know, because I would call on them for their wisdom. But as I get older, I'm beginning to understand that they actually need me. They need me to continue their work. So part of the expanding awareness we're talking about, part of the physical or the metaphysical expansion that accompanies the disintegration of the material sense, is the sense that we're part of a huge ongoing story of what came before us and what we imagine is going to come after us. So how does my life serve that ongoing story? What have I made clear to myself and hopefully to other people? What acts of service have I rendered so that other people's path is clear? You know, for those people who've had children, they've got hands-on experience with that. I've brought these lives into the world. For those of us who don't have children, what is that impulse? How does it manifest itself? You know, so interestingly enough, it brings me to when we had Susan Malter on. And I'm still thinking of Minnie and Josephine, you know, sitting behind these little tiny ladies sitting behind the wheel of the car who were with each other, you know, come hell or high water. But what I got from her episode was to live as though death is inevitable, but without it becoming a pall or a dark cloud, but basically understanding that the moment I have in front of me right now has expansive potential because it won't always be here. So part of the expansion, the metaphysical that you've introduced into the conversation, what if we were to practice that knowing that we were going to die? So in other words, knowing that this may be the only time I do this, or this is the only time this happens with this particular person on this day at this time of year, what if our expanded awareness of what's happening right now is part of what death's gift is to us? Maybe death's gift is the metaphysical, because ultimately we transcend the physical when we go. So if we're looking at places for, you know, the conversation to continue, that's one that really interests me.
Death is not an end point.
No.
On the physical plane it is, but not necessarily in other levels of consciousness, which I'm not equipped to really comment on. I just know that that's true. And always looking for the some sort of enlightened moment where that just feels okay to just let it be that way. Because we don't know what happens when we die. We don't know.
No.
We don't know. I know being at the bedside of dying people throughout my career and in my life, it would be just like, okay, I just kind of want to tune into where is this person going? What's in their head? What are they looking at? What are they feeling? Messages are they getting? What are they seeing? You know, and then, so I'm trying to interpret a leaving of the physical world using the physical world instruments.
Yeah. As a point of departure, sure.
Yeah. I'm using those instruments where those instruments don't work anymore, but it's...
I'm flying without instruments now.
Yeah, we're flying without instruments. And I think that that's a given, but certainly in terms of preparing for our own death, knowing that we have options, knowing that we have that autonomy, and having that discussion with ourselves first and, you know, with our loved ones and our families and people we live with, our community, and certainly with your medical providers.
And, yep.
And then, you know, you never know when you're going to have to evacuate your soul from your body.
That's right.
Yeah. And some of us don't get a warning. Other people are on a journey where they know that they are terminal. They have a terminal illness. And but that's not everybody.
No. And I think the wisdom of the conversation we had with Susan was to carry the awareness that if death is promised, what does that mean about how I choose to live my life? And if death's core lessons are vitality, presence, and gratitude, I can't think of more expansive ways to live. If maybe the expansiveness that I imagine we experience when we die, you know, as Ram Dass would say, you know, becoming nothing first involves becoming something, or becoming no one involves becoming, you know, someone first. So if my life has been about becoming someone, an identity, if I can carry the awareness that at some point that identity will have no value in the place I'm going, but something else might, the way I can align myself and gather some momentum and some propulsion out of this life is to live according to what's most important to me, so that I'm in alignment with what gives me vitality and presence and gratitude, so that when I leave, I am a natural next step, a natural byproduct of the effort to live generously in that way. So, and I think of generosity not only in terms of giving, but in terms of generating. So what can my life, how can my life generate momentum into and beyond my death? So it's like the, you know, the those jumbo jets getting the necessary internal combustion to lift off the runway finally. It's always kind of a miracle to me being inside one of those things, yeah. Watching this thing happen. How does this get off the ground? There's this interesting kind of friction point where weight becomes weightlessness. So,
and a lot of us are scritched down in our seats going, we're going to die.
Exactly. And then coming back down has its own kind of trauma. But I imagine that the way I can access that higher octane of fuel needed to get that internal combustion so that I can lift off comes from being true to who I am. And understanding, that's an evolving understanding in my life. I'm not always sure when I'm younger how to answer that question. As I get older, I get more evidence, I get more data. And, you know, I begin to tune into things like ancestors, like descendants, beginning to understand my life as part of an ongoing story, at least for me. Then I begin to think about, okay, this is why I'm here. This is why I'm doing this. And my understanding of that place gives me agency, autonomy, power to move on.
Yeah, agency and empowerment are really important concepts in any social justice movement or any social justice conversation. What you're describing sounds beautiful. It's something to aspire to. It's something I need to like click into like throughout the day. To keep the momentum, to keep the particularly during these difficult times, to keep that synergy, to keep the vitality of my own being grounded and ready to serve for others.
Mm-hmm.
It's huge.
It's
huge during these times. And I think of people who are, but I am privileged that I have the opportunity to do that. And so with death and dying issues that we've been discussing for the last 12 months, I'm asking you folks, what other community radio station talks about death and dying on a Tuesday morning?
With such joy.
With such joy, with such verve. You know, we're talking about vitality as we die. I'm all for it. But I also realize that it's difficult for people who are barely treading water to wrap mm-hmm. their minds around these. And so expanding the notion of options at the end of life, to me, is pivotal. And once again, I feel that there's a moral imperative to, I'm going to get off my soapbox.
It's okay.
It's to bring this into a societal conversation, to expand it to medical providers, hospice. There are hospice teams in the state of New Mexico that will not do medical aid in dying. They are, the nurses that go out are been told, you cannot talk about this. Their medical director says, you cannot tell people that they can get medical aid in dying. And some hospices do honor it, some don't. And how do people access this information, I think, is really important. So how to take this topic and make it palatable and accessible to all people, just like food, okay? Mm-hmm. People need vegetables. We're supposed to be eating like 3 to 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. How many people get that? How many people can get that? How many people at their end of their lives are going to be able to access this information? I think those are the thoughts that I ponder in terms of the social justice perspective of autonomy mm-hmm. and agency and delivering that message in such a way to empower all people across the spectrum, socioeconomic lines, if people want it. You know, but I think having this conversation at least once a month mm-hmm. is probably a good idea.
I think so. And I think what you're raising is important. And I know we're getting close
to
our end time, is that The thing that you're talking about that I think is most important that will cross in lines of disagreement is the idea of how death can teach us to appreciate the value of life. And if I look at appreciation like an asset appreciating, if I leave it, give it favorable conditions, feed it in the right way, then it expands, it enhances in value. So one thing that death can teach us is to really enhance the value of our life so that, and one thing that really can teach us how to enhance that value is expressing and experiencing autonomy within it, the maximum or optimum amount of choice. So I'm looking forward to where this conversation goes. I can't wait to take up more space with some of these ideas, and I'm grateful for the space that, you know, you've given us on this program.
Yeah, it's just a beginning, and I appreciate your intelligence and your sensibility about this, Scott.
And thank you.
How comfortable you make our guests when they come to talk about a difficult situation.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it is very, very personal.
Mm-hmm.
We've had personal stories from every one of our guests, and this is you've created a space where that's safe.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
As have you,
yeah.
Partner.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Cool. So I'm going to wrap it up. This is another episode of Beyond the Border and on Tuesday Morning Beat. As always, I love spending my Tuesday mornings with you.